today on Against the Grain. According to conventional wisdom, the Industrial Revolution was driven by innovative genius and unfettered private enterprise. According to Priasadia, the Industrial Revolution was driven by war-making, the production of firearms, and massive state intervention. I'm CS, the Stanford University historian, joins me to discuss her new book, Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What made the Industrial Revolution a revolution? Was it technical innovation? Was it entrepreneurial genius? Was it the flourishing of private enterprises free from state intervention? Or was it something different, something less savory, something rooted in the fact that Britain at the time of the Industrial Revolution was almost constantly at war? In her new book, Priasadia argues that the emergence of industrial capitalism was inextricable from war-making, from the mass production of guns with which Britain pursued its wars of imperial conquest. War, she contends, shaped the very invention of industrialism. War, she writes, made the Industrial Revolution. Priasadia is professor of history at Stanford University. Her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. When Priya joined me in studio, I asked her how a key figure in her book, a Quaker in Britain named Samuel Galton Jr., earned his fortune.
Samuel Galton Jr. was the third generation of a Quaker family in Birmingham that made its fortune through the manufacturing of firearms, but also many other kinds of metal goods, some of them related to firearms and some not.
How big was his gun-making firm, the part that made guns, and to whom or what did it supply arms?
So the Galton firm was the single biggest gun-making firm in Birmingham, perhaps also in England in the 18th century. They were supplying guns to the British government through the Office of Ordnance, but they were also supplying guns to chartered companies like the East India Company and the Hudson's Bay Company, who were, you know, sort of commercial operations, but were also partners of the government. They were chartered by the government, and so we can't really think of them as sort of separate private entities. They also supplied guns to the Irish government, which was, of course, part of the same imperial formation, but had its own sort of contracts for guns. And then there were a range of other private purchasers as well, people involved in the slave trade, you know, the Royal African Company, but also private traders who were trading on their own behalf. And then other kinds of governments as well. For instance, the Portuguese government would buy guns from them. So they had a range of customers, but they were supposed to prioritize the British government when it needed guns during a time of war. And this was a period in which the British government was almost always at war.
Yeah, tell us more. So between 1688 and 1815, how often or how frequently was Britain at war?
Britain was almost always at war. So that period starts, you know, after 1689, you get the start of what's called the 9 Years' War, which lasts for 9 years. And then there's the War of the Spanish Succession just a few years after that. And then there's a bit of a gap before the War of the Austrian Succession, which starts in 1739, 1740. And that ends in 1748. And then a few years later, you have the 7 Years' War, which is known as the French and Indian War in American history textbooks, and that lasts for 7 years. And then there's a few years of gap, and then the American Revolutionary War, which is another long global war. And then finally, from 1793 to 1815, there is this very, very long epic series of wars against France, against revolutionary France, and then Napoleon's France. And so even in those little gaps between the wars, however, it's not that Britain is actually at peace, because it's an expanding empire. So it remains in conflict at the edges of this ever-expanding empire. So, for instance, in that gap in the 1730s, it is still at war with different groups in the West Indies, with Native American nations in North America, with different powers in South Asia that it's trying to subjugate. So it's not like there's a real interlude of peace at any moment in this long 18th century.
So Galton's firm was making guns, among other things. He was a Quaker. How did Quakers feel about war making?
So what most people know about Quakers is that they believe in the unchristian nature of war, and Quakers are not supposed to bear arms. They're not supposed to profit from war in any way. But the really interesting thing here is that the Galton family, so this Galton Jr. and his forefathers, had been involved in gun making from at least 1702. And there doesn't seem to be any record of any kind of objection from the Quaker community for almost the entire century. And then when you get to the 1790s, suddenly you see a lot of objections from Quakers in London, and then finally from Quakers in Birmingham as well, who are saying, you know, as a Quaker, Galton Jr. should not be pursuing this business, and he must give it up. And if he does not give it up, he should be disowned by the Society of Friends.
And part of the reason why they confronted him only in 1795 was because of what guns meant and what guns were used for over the course of the 18th century. So can you share with us sort of the developing image of the gun and the ways in which guns were used or not up till the late 18th century?
Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the key explanations for that timing, for why the Quaker community finds this objectionable in the 1790s and not earlier, is that guns start to look objectionable in a new way in the 1790s. So yes, Quakers are not supposed to bear arms, but it wasn't clear that firearms, in particular, the firearms of that period, were always clearly and exclusively a kind of weapon of war. So many Quakers owned arms in this period. You would need them for agricultural reasons, if you're trying to get rid of crows or vermin on your land. So there were those kinds of totally legitimate uses for Quakers and non-Quakers. But primarily, I mean, guns were used by property owners, and they were understood as essential to the protection of property. And this was a period in which property meant civilization itself, and the regime that was established in the Revolution of 1689 was about the right to property and the establishment of a whole kind of national regime based on that notion. And there were no formal police forces in this period. And so what you had instead were property owners owning firearms and using them as a sort of deterrent. People in this period did not use firearms in crimes of passion, in a moment of fury. Rioting crowds and mobs did not use firearms either. And the reason they didn't is because of the way that firearms worked in this period. They were very slow. They were very unwieldy. They were very unreliable. You never quite knew what would happen when you pulled a trigger. And that made them really poor weapons to reach for in a moment of emotion and fury. But they could be quite handy then if you wanted to sort of impersonally threaten a stranger who's trespassing on your property. Now, this is the reality of and the understanding of guns and gun use for most of the 18th century, and that starts to shift in the 1790s. During those long end-of-century wars against France, there's such an unprecedented scale of mass exposure to firearms. So much of the British male population is exposed to firearms, you start to see a kind of shift in the way they are used. And for the first time, you see reports of gun violence that have nothing to do with property and also nothing to do with passion. New kinds of random or casual violence that's quite meaningless and is often perpetrated by ex-soldiers. And suddenly, firearms start to look bad in a new way. And I think that's why the Quaker sect starts to object to Galton's business, particularly in that moment, but also because of the abolition movement that really starts to take off just a few years before this controversy erupts around Galton. And guns figure centrally in the slave trade and become part of the sort of negative publicity about it. The fact that bad guns are dumped in West Africa, or the fact that guns are used on plantations for really sort of wanton forms of violence. And so it's partly the way Galton looks from the standpoint of the Quaker abolition movement and the concern that Quakers have about sort of ethical consistency on a national stage in that moment as they take the lead in this movement. They really are concerned about scandal, and then guns look so particularly scandalous in that moment that finally they raise questions about Galton only in that moment.
And they confront him formally in 1795, as we've been talking about. This is the Quakers, the Society of Friends in Birmingham, England. So how does he respond? What does he do? How does he frame his response to these accusations?
So, you know, he saw himself as a sort of man of the Enlightenment, and he was not sort of cowed by the fingers being raised at him. And what he decided to do was to write a defense of his position as a Quaker gunmaker, and he printed it and circulated it. Because he had that much faith in what he was saying, and he meant it, as he explains in the document itself, it was for posterity, it was for his children and grandchildren, so that they would understand where he was coming from. And I think that's a really important point when we think of the merits of his arguments and how sincerely he meant them or didn't mean them. So he made two main arguments. One was this argument that, you know, yes, guns can sometimes be used as weapons, but they are not always weapons, and that they are part of the spread of civilization. They are like doorknobs and hinges and things that protect property. Okay, so we've talked about that. And we know that until this point, that was kind of a general understanding of guns, but that had begun to shift for many British people by the 1790s. So he was a little late on that. The second big argument he made, though, was that there was little he could do as an economic participant in the West Midlands, in the Birmingham area where he lived, that would not also in some way contribute to war. You know, even if he sat at home and twiddled his thumbs and just paid his taxes, he would be contributing to war. And I think the point he was making was that the emerging industrial economy in particular in the West Midlands owed much to all this continuous war in the 18th century. And he could not have been unaware of the fact that the fellow Quakers who were appointed to kind of reclaim him from this business were people like members of the Lloyd family, the founders of Lloyd's Bank in England today, who were, you know, fellow Quakers. They were relations of the Galton family as well, but they had formerly been the iron suppliers to that gun firm and had founded their bank from the wealth accumulated through providing iron to various kinds of military-related manufacturing. And even as bankers, they were important sources of war financing to the British government. And so from where he sat, Galton is looking at Lloyd and saying, what's the difference between me and you? Maybe it's a difference of degree, but we're arguing about principle here. And so if it's about principle, degree doesn't really matter. And this is really a matter that you have to leave to private conscience to decide.
That's Priya Sadia. She is professor of history at Stanford University, and we are talking about her new book, Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So how would you assess, and part of this book project, I think, is about assessing Galton's defense of himself, and specifically that argument that everybody in this economy, this rapidly transforming economy of Birmingham and environs, was in some way contributing to the state's war-making powers, that they were all somehow complicit in war and in the making of arms. So how would you assess the accuracy of that argument?
So I think when I found that document, when I first started this project, many, many, many years ago, I decided I wanted to test the merits of what Galton was saying. And I thought, and the reason I wanted to do so is that the stakes were very clear and high to me. If he was right that the industrial economy emerging in the West Midlands was emerging thanks to war and government demand related to war, then we have gotten the story of the Industrial Revolution wrong, because we've told it primarily as a very kind of Pacific story about enterprise and very limited government involvement and the unleashing of invention and knowledge networks. And it's just a very, very peaceful story that has nothing to do with the fact that Britain was almost continuously at war in the very period of the Industrial Revolution. And it seemed to me that if Galton was right, then there was a whole new narrative about the Industrial Revolution to be told that we had missed for a very, very long time. And so it was worth it to me to sort of test the merits of his arguments. And then I went about doing the research to see if he was right about the gun industry in particular. You know, was its transformation in the 18th century due to government demand related to war? And then if it was it anomalous in that sense? Or could you make a similar argument about other industries as well? And by the end of, you know, the time I took to write this book, I was persuaded that he was right, that in fact, much of the economic transformation you see in this period in a range of industries, much of that can be traced to war-related demand coming from the state, various different state offices.
Yeah, and if we start with just the guns and the arms, what can you tell us then about the state's involvement in these industries? And I guess military contracts, government military contracts, play a large role. Is that right?
Yes. So if you look at the gun industry, at the beginning of the period we're talking about, British gun makers could make tens of thousands of guns in a year. And those were the needs of war at the time.
This is the late 17th century.
Correct. In the late 17th century. By the early 19th century, by the time of the Napoleonic Wars, British gunmakers could make millions of guns in a year. So that's a pretty revolutionary transformation. And what's interesting is it was not the result of the addition of lots and lots of machinery, which is how we usually think of the Industrial Revolution. There were some new machines, particularly in barrel grinding and welding. But for the most part, it remained a very artisanal process. And so what I saw happening was that when these government offices would put out contracts for guns, and when they would get frustrated with the rate of production not being as quick as they needed, they would go in, officials would go into town in Birmingham and tinker with various different mechanisms available to them to try and speed up production. And they also just expand the number of people involved in production. And then they keep playing with the organization of the industry so that the same artisanal community that could make only tens of thousands at the start of the period was able to make millions by the end. So just to give you a few examples, they play with price incentives. They tried to collectivize reception of parts, certain parts that were proving to be bottlenecks in the process, in order to eliminate competition between gun contractors. They created bounty systems to ensure that parts makers would remain dedicated to certain contractors and in supplying them rather than sort of allowing other contractors to swoop in and get them on cheaper terms. The government added funds to enable more people to be trained to make the most difficult parts of the guns, namely the gun lock. The government is also doing all kinds of things to support this industry in those interludes of peace by encouraging gun makers and supporting gun makers in their efforts to sell their guns abroad to other customers in the slave trade, in South Asia, in North America, and so on and so forth. They have a really clear understanding of the importance of keeping this industry healthy so that when war inevitably breaks out again in a matter of a few years, gun makers will still be around and able to produce on a very vast scale.
So what you're talking about is massive government intervention. And are you saying then that without that intervention, the Industrial Revolution and kind of commercial and industrial life in 18th century Britain would have been different?
Yes, I do want to say that, especially for this area in the West Midlands. I mean, I think the influence of government contracts and government intervention will vary from region to region, industry to industry. But I do think you can make a case, certainly for the wool industry, for the agricultural industry, for copper industries, iron industries, the financial world, that much of the development in those areas was stimulated in some fashion by war-related government demand. I think the cotton textile industry, which is where we often focus our attention when we're talking about the British Industrial Revolution, is perhaps, cotton textiles were not really militarily useful, unlike woolen textiles, which were used for soldiers' uniforms. But even the machinery that was developed that made a revolutionary scale of cotton production possible in Britain in this period, a lot of that machinery was being developed by people with ties to Birmingham or from Birmingham who were also involved in designing machines or working on kind of metal industries that were related to the war story. So I think it's hard to quantify, but I do think, generally speaking, yes, this is a big, big missing piece of the story of the Industrial Revolution, that the government had a big role in it and that it did so because it was always engaged in war.
Can you give us other examples of ripple effects that the gun and arms making industry had on other commercial enterprises?
Yes. So precision instruments, iron manufacturing, clocks, jewelry, the whole range of Birmingham goods called toys, which are any kind of sort of small metal objects like buckles and buttons and things that were produced in Birmingham. Lots of these industries, some of the innovations that would first take place in gun manufacture would then be applied in these other industries as well. And some of the people who were making guns would also be involved in the manufacture of toys and precision instruments and things like that. There was a great deal of overlap. And then this backward linkage to iron production was important as well, because gun makers were very, very fussy and particular about the kind of iron they used. And so you do see gun makers involved in a lot of the experimentation in producing purer and stronger forms of iron and even steel in the Birmingham area in this period.
Another way in which you document kind of the state intervention or meddling or whatever you want to call it in the economy and toward the or in connection with the private sector is based upon a fear that the British government had about concentration within the gun-making, armaments-making industry. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So there was a revolution in 1689 called the Glorious Revolution that created a constitutional monarchy in Britain. And after that revolution, though, there were concerns about groups within the country who would like to undo that revolution. And those groups were known as Jacobites. And this Jacobite threat was real. There were Jacobite rebellions periodically in the first half of the 18th century. So it's this sort of specter haunting the new regime set up in 1689. And so at the start of this period, the British government could get guns primarily from a chartered company called the Worshipful Company of Gunmakers that was located in the Minories around the Tower of London. They also imported a lot of guns from the Netherlands. Now, the new British government after 1689 is nervous about this, because if Jacobites managed to get a hold of those gunmakers or that company of gunmakers, if they managed to bribe them or co-opt them, or if those gunmakers have political sympathy with the Jacobite cause, then what? And the Dutch source was also not totally reliable, because in a time of war, of course, that source could be cut off. So there was this sense that they needed to develop alternate sites of gun production. And so you see, just shortly after the revolution in 1689, this effort by the government to nurture into existence a whole new gun-making industry in this Birmingham region. And so even the very start of that industry owed so much to government And it was with this political objective in mind of creating rival centers, multiple centers of gun production to avoid the risk of an overly concentrated industry that might more easily be captured by internal enemies in the country.
Priya Sadia joins me in studio. She is an historian based at Stanford University. She's the author of Spies in Arabia, The Great War, and the Cultural Foundations of Britain's Covert Empire in the Middle East. We are talking about her new book. It's called Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution, which uses the gun industry as a window into the relationship between the Industrial Revolution and wars of imperial conquest. Wars, of course, pursued in this case by Britain. So, you know, when we think about state intervention today, we think about the building of infrastructure, the creation of public works, financing education and schools. Did the British state in the period we're talking about, did it see itself as a provider of these kinds of services and, you know, concrete structures?
I think in this period, these were emerging ideas. One thing we have to be careful of is we are used to thinking about state and economy as two clearly distinct things. But what you see happening in the 18th century in Britain is the emergence of clearly distinct state institutions and what you might want to call private economic institutions from what was kind of just a mess of both. So, for instance, people who were contractors were also sometimes salaried employees of the government. It wasn't really clear who was a private individual and who was a state employee and belonging to the realm of state office. And that's something that people start to demand clarity on around the middle of the 18th century, because the have-nots in this arrangement get mad about it. And so by the early 19th century, then you do see this effort of sort of making it clear what are state institutions, how are they separate from the economy, and these theories positing, you know, an economy that government does not interfere in, and so on and so forth. So with that in mind, there was not a sort of counterfactual way in which the government could have interfered in or invested in the so-called economy in a more constructive way, say by building schools or canals or infrastructure and all the things that you mentioned. That concept of government just didn't exist yet. But what's interesting is that the government did have a sense of sort of paternalistic obligation towards industry and towards workers generally. And that was partly out of this sense of the political insecurity that could be created if they did not show that concern. So if they weren't concerned about the health of the gun industry, one, then they would not have gun makers at the ready when the next war broke out. And two, there would be a lot of unemployed men around who might then become Jacobites. So it was in the interest of the government to sort of ensure that industry was healthy. So you do see that kind of concern.
Yeah, you're right that in much of the 18th century, the state existed entirely to provide the resources for war. So you have this kind of war-driven industrial revolution, which, as you said, kind of overturns some of maybe our conventional views of what the industrial revolution was and what caused it. How did British government officials feel about people in British colonies acquiring and using the industrial knowledge and innovation being developed in places like the Midlands?
Yes. So Galton, I mentioned, was someone who could see that war contracts were driving industrialism in his area. But he, and that sort of fascinated me, and it seemed like he had a kind of unique perspective. But as I dug deeper, I realized that many people could see that connection. It's only us, later on, we have lost sight of that. And what I found that there were conversations in Bengal, for instance, where British officials of the East India Company are saying, you know, we're importing an awful lot of military equipment from England. Wouldn't it be cheaper to take advantage of Indian metalworking skill and just buy things here. And then the answers that come from other officials are, you know, very clear on this, that, you know, that would be extremely dangerous. First of all, then the mother country, quote unquote, capital M, capital C, the mother country will lose profits, but they don't want to be encouraging the preservation and extension of that kind of metalworking knowledge, especially related to making weapons and war material, because then that could drive an industrial takeoff in the Bengal region, which would also be harmful to the interests of the mother country. So there was a consciousness of that these things are related and that they must certainly not encourage the growth of metalworking skills in Bengal, but they should even work hard to suppress even existing Indian or Bengali knowledge about metalworking, because there were very rich, even gun-making traditions in many parts of South Asia at this point. And you can see over the course of the 18th century how in each place the British co-opt existing manufacturing capacity, suppress it, and also start providing British arms instead to those local Indian powers in order to, again, suppress that indigenous manufacturing capacity and to make those Indian powers more beholden to the British.
That's the voice of Priya Sadia. She is professor of history at Stanford University, and her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. It's published by Penguin. We'll take a short break and speak more with Priya about her very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Priya Satia is my guest, S-A-T-I-A. She teaches history at Stanford University. Her writings have appeared in Slate, The Nation, The Huffington Post, and many other publications. She's the author of Spies in Arabia, and her new book is Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Her book reframes the Industrial Revolution, the expansion of British Empire, and the emergence of industrial capitalism by presenting them as inextricable from the gun trade. So what you're saying is, in this period of 1689 to 1815, British society wasn't just an industrial society, it was a military-industrial society, which then makes me think of the military-industrial complex, which is a term that I think Dwight Eisenhower formulated, and he was kind of warning U.S. society that this military-industrial complex is gaining power in the U.S. How would you compare that kind of military-industrial society with the military-industrial complex that emerged in the 20th century?
Yes, I do think that they're related. I mean, I think the complex that we live with today emerged from this earlier history of a more diffuse military-industrial society. I think what's different, the reason I'm using the word society rather than complex for the 18th century, is because of the emphasis that the British government put on keeping certain industries like the gun industry diffuse. They didn't want a complex. What they were concerned about was that if they just had one or two really favorite, really reliable suppliers, that those suppliers would have way too much power. And then again, if they switched their loyalties to Jacobites, then that would leave the government nowhere. So they were very, very dedicated to the idea of just keeping it diffuse, which makes it something different from the complex that we are familiar with today. That said, I do think there's a moment in the second half of the 19th century where you can sort of see this military-industrial society changing and becoming something more recognizably complex-like. And I think that has to do with the concentration of industry, the corporatization of industry that happens in the second half of the 19th century. That's when you have the emergence, for instance, of BSA, the Birmingham Small Arms Factory, which becomes the single largest rifle maker in Europe by the end of the 19th century. And you see, in the early 20th century, the British government just only relies on one or two British suppliers for most of its needs, but it can also starts to source many arms abroad as well. And so you see this kind of concentration and shrinking of, it's not a shrinking in the numbers of people participating, but in the number of contractors or big corporations that the British government partners with. And so that is distinct from the 18th century, when you do just see a much more diffuse level of participation, with lots of people making small profit working for and with the government, as opposed to the 20th century, when we're talking about a few companies making lots of profits. And it's a different kind of, you know, scale of corruption, if you want to call it that, by the 20th century.
So if we go back to 1795, again, the Society of Friends in Birmingham, they confront Samuel Galton Jr., this owner of this large gun-making firm in Birmingham, and they say, we are going to disown you unless you stop this business because it's immoral. And you've told us about the arguments that he presented to them, and he actually, as you said, published this document. So how did they respond to his defense of what he was doing, and maybe specifically this idea that, you know, we're all complicit in it, so, you know, why are you accusing me in particular?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The Religious Society of Friends didn't buy his argument. And within a few months after he publishes this defense, the disownment process unfolds. And formally, he's disowned. But it doesn't affect him. He continues to go to the local meeting and attend the worship. He continues to make donations to Quaker charitable causes, and his donations are accepted. And this, it's important to note, this is at a moment during the Napoleonic Wars when his gun-making enterprise really starts to make enormous profits on a whole new scale. And yet he remains part of this Quaker community and ignores the disownment, basically. And I think that says something about his standing in the local Quaker community, that perhaps if his arguments were not accepted formally, there must have been enough people in the Birmingham group who sympathized or kind of got what he meant, and who knew they were complicit as well, like the Lloyds, and so sort of tolerated him, his continued presence among them. That said, then the Samuel Galton Jr. does, shortly into the 19th century, pass on ownership of the firm to his son, who's called Samuel Tertius Galton. And they also start a bank. And so there's about a decade when Samuel Tertius Galton is both the head of this Galton Bank and the head of the gun-making firm. And he marries outside the Quaker fold. And so he sort of falls out of Quaker ranks for that reason. But then after 1815, when the wars end, the Galton gun-making business is wound up, and they are only bankers after that point. And their bank becomes, you know, one of the components of what became Midland Bank, which in the 1990s, I want to say, was folded into HSBC, which is still with us today.
When the Quakers refused to accept Samuel Galton Jr.'s arguments, what that says to me is that there was a kind of denial of moral responsibility among the Quaker community, right? That they didn't see themselves as being morally culpable in relation to what was going on with militarism and gun making and arms making and the interrelationship of all these industries and finance with war making. What does that tell you, this sort of refusal to accept moral responsibility for something that, I guess, if you looked at maybe more objectively, you would say, yeah, they're complicit?
So I think what you see is this logic operating, right? Where by pointing their finger at Galton as sort of a particularly morally culpable figure because he's a gun maker, the Quaker society then feels comfortable generally, you know, in its conscience that the rest of the community is above reproach in some sense. And they've identified the scandalous figure in their midst. And I think this is a kind of process of cleansing, you want moral cleansing or purification, that I think echoes down the line in the history of capitalism generally. You see it happening here in the Quaker community, but I think this is something we habitually do. We say drug trafficking is bad, or the slave trade is bad, or arms trafficking, arms trading is bad. But otherwise, the rest of trade and capitalism is all right. And I think what this story about Galton in the era of the Industrial Revolution shows us is that so many people are complicit in these things, almost de facto and ineluctably in the trade or in the manufacture and trade of things like drugs or guns or the procurement of slaves, that there is a sort of faulty logic in trying to focus our energies on eliminating those sort of bad goods and thinking that the rest of it can continue to operate intact. And I do think that right now we're sort of confronting this with the gun control movement in the United States, where there's this effort to boycott businesses and industries that are implicated in the manufacture and sale of things like AR-15s. And we're finding that you have to cast a very, very wide net to actually boycott the various different kinds of businesses that are involved, because lots and lots of kinds of businesses and industries are complicit, from banks to advertising firms to retailers to law firms. I mean, it's very, very, we're discovering just how wide that net of complicity is. And I think this is something that's been true from the beginning, and that these bad goods are actually a product of the whole system of industrial capitalism, not just a few bad guys who commit to making or selling those things.
In other words, a structural critique is needed, maybe in place of simply focusing on a presumably isolated sector of the economy or a bad commodity.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Priya Satya joins me. She is professor of history at Stanford University. Her new book is Empire of Guns: The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. So you spoke earlier about the conventional argument that the Industrial Revolution was driven by free enterprise with a minimum of government interference. How influential has that argument been on discussions of what drives innovation and economic growth and what role governments should play in the economy?
I think that idea has been extremely influential, and it's sort of been the source of our default understanding that if you want economic progress, especially since the 1990s, if you want economic progress in any country, the government needs to stop interfering. And you can think of many different cases where that logic has been applied. And I think if you look at Britain in particular, there has been this sense, for instance, with the rise of the welfare state after World War II, that was really revolutionary. That here you have a country in which traditionally the government has refrained from interfering in the economy. That's why there was an industrial revolution. And now suddenly, in a new way, the government is interfering in the economy, has a huge presence in the economy. And people who see the narrative that way in the last couple of decades have worked really hard to dismantle that post-World War II welfare state so that Britain can return to a more kind of authentically British version of itself, in which the government has a very small role in the economy. So if we now find that, in fact, traditionally, or at least from the beginning of the history of modern state institutions in Britain, the British government has had a very big role in the economic transformations that country saw, then this post-World War II welfare state does not look like such a dramatic break with the past, where before you had a warfare state, now you have a welfare state. But all along, for most of the modern period, that means the British state has had a presence, a very kind of foundational presence in the British economy, and has really shaped the dimensions of its evolution in the modern period. So there's a lot at stake in revising our understanding of the Industrial Revolution. And just if you look at the developing world today and the arguments people come up with against government interference or the conditions that are put, you know, on loans that are given to such governments that, you know, you have to follow certain neoliberal conditions. I mean, all of this can be traced in some sense to the idea that the first instance of industrial takeoff in the world, which happened in Britain, was all about a situation in which government knew its place and didn't interfere. So once you change that story, you upset a lot of conventional wisdom about what the government's role should be in innovation and in development. If you look at Silicon Valley itself, I mean, we also have a mythology about that as sort of the flourishing of genius and innovation and invention and free enterprise. But if memory serves you correctly, you know, it should remind you that Silicon Valley grew up thanks to Cold War defense contracts. And even today, a lot of the biggest names in Silicon Valley, companies like Google, they do get very important defense contracts. And sometimes those are controversial, as they should be.
So 18th century Britain, the Industrial Revolution, a state of almost constant war, war making being kind of an obsession of the successive governments in Britain, and of course the industries that supplied the war making effort. I guess my question is, like, do you think 18th century British state would have industrialized if it had not been constantly at war? I mean, how important was war to the whole driving of the, and in fact, maybe even the existence of the Industrial Revolution?
I do think you would have seen industrialism in Britain, but I don't think it would have been a revolutionary event. I think that scale of transformation owed a lot to war. I think in so many places in the world, you see increasing industrial activity. Right, on the continent, in South Asia, in parts of the Middle East, it's not something, industrialism is not something unique to Britain, but the Industrial Revolution, that scale of change in Britain, I think does have something to do with war, with the fact that Britain was always at war. And I think that because it comes out of these wars of colonial conquest, in which there was this conscious effort to also decrease or smother industrialism in other places, that also helped the scale of change become more revolutionary within Britain. If there hadn't been those wars of colonial conquest, there would have been industrialism in Britain, but there would also have been industrialism in Bengal and in Awadh and in other places around the world that Britain was behaving belligerently in. Even in North America and the American colonies, I mean, they developed the way they did because of British colonialism, so it's sort of a weird counterfactual. But you know, the efforts to ignite industrial activity there were very actively suppressed by British industrialists at home because they were always concerned about the mother country. And this is what colonists in the Americas were rebelling against. This was one of the thorns in their side that they wanted to get rid of when it came to the 1760s, 1770s. So yeah, I think it would have been a much more even process globally, and less revolutionary within Britain itself.
You point in this book to a lot of thinkers, maybe the majority of thinkers, who wanted to or would or have kind of denied the role of war making in the Industrial Revolution, who have said that arms making, if anything, had kind of a negative effect, a negative impact on the economy, or was maybe kind of an ancillary part of the economic activity that constituted this extraordinary transformation in commercial and industrial life. Why do you think thinkers would do that? Why discount or ignore the role of war in the Industrial Revolution?
So I think there are three reasons for that. One is just the enormous influence of liberal political economic theory. So even though I'm finding now that war was a big factor in industrial transformation in Britain in this period, Adam Smith was writing at the same time and inventing theories of economic growth in which the government and war had the most, the negligible role possible. And I think that theory has in some ways displaced reality. So that's one reason. The second reason is that a lot of our scholarship on the Industrial Revolution started to come out, a lot of the sort of seminal work on it started to come out in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, in the period of the World Wars. And in that period, the thinkers who were making arguments about war driving economic growth were often sympathetic to Nazi thought, like people like Werner Sombart, the sociologist. And I think the stakes for saying that, no, there's a really important foundational case of economic growth in which war did not have a role, the stakes for saying that and believing that were very, very high. People didn't want to have, didn't know, it's such an unseemly idea, and it's very hard to live with. But I think what's happened is that it's sort of left us in a kind of denial about the reality of war's role in the Industrial Revolution. So, and the third reason is that I think there's a sense of, what's the word I want to use? I mean, there's, broadly speaking, even today in the British education system and in popular culture, a continuing sort of denial about the negative effects, the negative impact of British imperialism. And I do think that's something to contend with on a broader scale, and I think painting the Industrial Revolution as this Pacific affair that didn't have anything to do with imperialism, that's not tainted by imperialism, I think that is important to the kind of British myth about itself. So I think that's a third reason why there is this continued avoidance of that possibility that wars of colonial conquest may have driven industrial transformation in Britain.
Yeah, right. This notion, as you're right, of the British Empire as a peaceable and mm-hmm. liberal empire, I mean, that would be subverted by, an emphasis on war's role in British economic growth.
Yes, there's this weird arrangement of scholarship on the 18th century where there's lots of books on the military history of the period, and then there's lots of books on the economic history, and you would read each one and not imagine that the other one existed. there's sort of parallel histories. And there's this sense that, yes, if there was a British Empire, it was a very Pacific entity. It brought civilization. It had a navy, maybe, but it was not this sort of violent, aggressive power. And that is a myth.
Priya Sadia, historian based at Stanford University. You can check out her book, Spies in Arabia, The Great War and the Cultural Foundations of Britain's Covert Empire in the Middle East. We've been talking about her new book published by Penguin. It's called Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Very interesting, intriguing book, Priya. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, C.S.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.